Chapter 6. Phallic Masculinities. On the 3rd of January 2018, US President Donald J. Trump opened a new front in his very public war of words with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un by boasting on social media about the size of his nuclear launch button. "Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times," Trump tweeted in his customary idiosyncratic style. "Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I too have a nuclear button," he continued, "but it's a much bigger and more powerful one than his, and my button works." Whether enraptured or enraged, most Westerners understood the president's tweet not only as a claim to military supremacy, but as an assertion of masculine superiority, couched in the competitive terms more commonly associated with penis bragging. This is unsurprising. The relationship between nuclear weapons and phallic culture in the modern West is well established and easily recognised. Hard, phallic, projected towards the skies, as one scholar puts it, the symbolism of this terrifying weapon is far from implicit. Nor is it incidental. The first Western nuclear bombs were gendered male and named Little Boy and Fat Man. They were created in 1942 by a predominantly male group of nuclear physicists who were sequestered from their families in what's been called a cult of male solidarity at a remote site in New Mexico. The successful conception and delivery of Little Boy and Fat Man spawned not only a global industry in nuclear armaments, to say nothing of the subsequent deaths and devastation of various human and ecological communities, but exacerbated the masculinist hypersexualization of warfare, which had long correlated the power of the penis with the imposition of order in the world. It's no coincidence that in mocking the size of Kim Jong-un's nuclear button, Donald Trump also characterized the world of North Korea as thoroughly disordered, paralleling the depleted and food-starved regime with the nuclear impotency of its ruler. Like so many military leaders of the modern world, the gods of ancient Southwest Asian societies also correlated the scale and impact of their weaponry with the size and virility of their penises. Bows, swords, clubs, and spears were all common phallic symbols and represented a certain form of alpha masculinity in which the aggression, bloodlust, dexterity, stamina, and physical strength of a warrior were aligned with a rock-hard erection, powerful jets of semen, a heightened sexual prowess, an insatiable libido, and penetrative domination. Of all weapons, the bow was particularly prized as the idealized phallus. In action, it mimics the erect ejaculating penis. Drawing back the string stretched the bow into a powerful state of tension, akin to a stiffened penis close to orgasm. The explosive release of tension shot the arrow fast and far, like a projectile spurt of semen, penetrating deep into the body of its target. As a highly skilled warrior, the human bowman was himself the embodiment of a devastating sexualized masculinity. Rather than bludgeoning or hacking at an opponent with a club or a sword in exhausting hand-to-hand combat, he fought from a fixed, erect position on his feet or up on his knees. Divinely blessed with precision timing, muscular agility, swiftness of movement and deft fingers, he exhibited the enviable ability to bring down the enemy from afar again and again without flagging. The phallic bow was naturally the weapon of choice for the gods. In the Babylonian epic Enuma-Elish, the great warrior god Marduk, patron of the city of Babylon, takes on Tiamat, the goddess embodying the primordial salt sea, with his great weapon, a huge, tightly strung bow called Deluge, a name playing on the storms and rains with which male warrior gods were so often associated. Tiamat's body shapeshifts throughout the myth, from primeval amniotic sac to warrior woman to scaly sea dragon, manifesting not only the uncontainable forces of disorder, but the misogynistic tendencies of Babylon's mythmakers themselves. "No matter how great a woman's strength, it's no match for a man," the other gods remind Marduk as he prepares to take her on. Tiamat's body quivers and quakes with a mixture of sexual anticipation and fear for her life as Marduk approaches on his mighty chariot, his enormous weapon raised in his hand. Forcing open her mouth with a stormy wind, Marduk shoots an arrow from Deluge deep into her throat. The arrow impales her insides, ripping her innards and piercing her heart. The sexual violence of the myth was not lost on Babylon's priests and scribes, who abbreviated its plot with pithy references to Marduk, who defeated Tiamat with his penis. In vanquishing his fearsome foe, Marduk wins kingship over the gods, while Deluge, his penis bow, is transformed into a celestial body and commemoratively suspended in the skies as a permanent sign, lest its power should ever be forgotten. The divine penis bow has indeed been remembered, although not quite as Marduk might have expected. Instead, it's associated with Yahweh, the god of the Bible. He too is a warrior deity whose signature weapons of thunderbolts and lightning strikes and torrential rains are equated with the devastating impact of his mighty bow and speeding arrows. Like Marduk's bow Deluge, Yahweh's bow is identified with his erect penis, albeit in the euphemistic language of bare flesh. "You brandish your bow of nakedness, you satisfy the shafts of your bowstring," enthuses the prophet Habakkuk in his gloriously graphic vision of Yahweh as the ultimate phallic warrior. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, this is the God who is said to crush the genitals of his enemy so that they cannot rise up against him. His weapon is so intimidating that when he approaches, his enemy's own bows slacken and droop, their penises sink, and their genitals tremble. More horrifying is the sexualized nature of Yahweh's punishing assault on his own people. When he turns his bow on Jerusalem, it's cast as a vicious, humiliating attack by a hypermasculine aggressor, as a poem in the 6th century BCE Book of Lamentations suggests. "He bent his bow and set me as his target for his arrow. He shot into my organs with the arrows of his quiver. He made my teeth break on gravel and made me cower in the dust." Of course, it's with his phallic bow that Yahweh, like Marduk, is said to have defeated the great sea monster, piercing its body to expose its innards. And he too appears to hang his bow in the skies. In the biblical story of the flood, which incorporates motifs drawn from the battle with aqueous chaos, Yahweh memorialises his subjugation of the deadly waters by suspending his war bow in the heavens. "My bow I have placed in the cloud," he declares. "When I bring a cloud over the earth and the bow appears in the cloud, I will remember my covenant which is between me and you and every living being, so that waters shall not again become a flood to annihilate all flesh." The transformation of his war bow into a rainbow was made easy in biblical Hebrew, in which the word keshet, bow, is used for both. But the phallic associations of this commemorative sky sign were clearly recognisable to his worshippers. When the prophet Ezekiel beheld God's genitalia, he likened what he saw to the deity's phallic weapon of war, describing the glorious sight to be as dazzling as the bow in a cloud on a rainy day. The rainbow at which so many of us have looked in delighted wonder is a polychrome vision of God's weaponized penis. The divine penis inserted itself into the human world in other ways too, not least on the battlefield. Across ancient Southwest Asia, war was not simply a tool of economic and territorial conflict, nor solely a means of ordering the world and its inhabitants into the civilized and the barbaric, or the victorious and the defeated. Warfare was idealized as a means of distinguishing the most masculine from the non-masculine. Like their gods, the Southwest Asian kings of the 2nd and 1st millennia BCE understood that the weapons of war represented their virility and masculinity, politically, socially, and personally. Written into imperial treaties and international trade policies were divine curses to be triggered should one party renege on the agreed relationship. Vassal kings would have their bows broken by the gods, their dynastic lines would be rendered sterile, their bodies would become impotent or effeminate. But just as it took more than a weapon to make a successful warrior, and more than a successful warrior to win a war, so it took more than a penis to make a man, and more than manliness to manifest masculinity. For gods and humans alike, This was a world governed and shaped by a network of multiple masculinities. Each was relative, contextual, and subject to the possibility of change. Aspects of these relative masculinities are well illustrated in the palace art of the Assyrian king Ashurnasirpal II, circa 883 to 859 BCE. Now in the British Museum, these images of the king's military campaigns, detailed with jaw-dropping intricacy, are carved into vast stone wall panels which once decorated the rooms of his palace at Kalhu, later named Nimrud, in what is now Iraq. They're unflinching in their depictions of war. Alongside row upon row of archers on foot and in chariots, severed heads, impaled corpses, and skin-flayed bodies decorate the landscape. The dead are trampled underfoot, captives are led off in ropes and shackles, families are rounded up for deportation, their donkeys and ox-drawn carts packed high with bundles of food and clothing. Amid all these bodies, different forms of masculinity are plotted against the phallic symbol of the bow. On one panel, King Ashurnasirpal is in his chariot, charging towards a group of enemy bowmen. The speed of the attack is seen in the taut, lean bodies of the stallions stretched into a gallop as they pull tight the thick reins held by the king's charioteer. Standing erect, his eyes fixed on his target, Ashurnasirpal draws back his bow, his arm muscles hardened into powerful curves. The fingers of his right hand are strong, long and slim, holding the end of the arrow shaft against the string. His left hand clasps the front of the bow, thumb raised and braced against the weapon's arch to guide the trajectory of the arrow balanced on his clenched fist. It's an exhibition of phallic hypermasculinity modelled and endorsed by Ashurnasirpal's god himself. In the skies above the king, set against his divine emblem, the Assyrian high god Ashur adopts the same position, pulling back his bow with his muscular arms, his gaze trained on the enemy. The warring king and the warrior deity are as one. By deliberate contrast, the bowmen targeted by Ashurnasirpal display a series of lesser masculinities. Although they too are fiercely mighty, they cannot compete with the aggressive virility of the king of Assyria. One aims his bow at the king, but its arch is weak, its string is limp, and his arms are bent and buckled. Another has lowered his bow altogether, its string positioned towards the king in a gesture of submission. The masculinity of a bowless man graphically declines further as he crawls on his hands and knees beneath the king's stallions, his buttocks raised towards the horse's genitals, as if they too are about to penetrate him as demonstrably as the arrows embedded in his back. Finally, the lost masculinity of a fallen warrior is presented. He lies dead or dying on the battlefield, his left arm splayed out, his right arm slung across his waist, his hand drooping on his impotent groin, while an eagle pecks out his eyes. In all the battle scenes on Assyrian wall panels of this era, the soldiers of Assyria are vertically positioned, standing erect, or raised up high on their knees as they brandish their bows, dominating the space between the earth and the skies. Every Assyrian body is sharply dressed in a military tunic and hard with a powerful tension. The bodies of the defeated are very different. They may be appropriately muscular, as all warriors were expected to be, but they're corporeally diminished. Some are weaponless, some are shoeless, and some are entirely naked, stripped of all cultural viability. The dead litter landscapes, their limbs as emphatically limp as their exposed penises. They lie butchered on the ground or suspended from walls and poles, floppy and folded. Nowhere in these images is an Assyrian seen to be penetrated or at risk of penetration. Instead, it's the Assyrian who penetrates, with arrows, with spears, with knives, and with a divinely endorsed authority granted by the bow-bearing high god himself. To be a penetrated male was to be downgraded, degraded, and devoid of masculinity. To be penetrated was not only to be emasculated, it was to be like a woman. Across ancient Southwest Asia, high-status ideologies of warfare and politics usually ran parallel to cultural norms of sex, gender, and sexuality. This was a patriarchal world in which social relationships tended to be structured on unequal terms, distinguishing between the penist and the non-penist, the penetrators and the penetrated, the dominant and the submissive, the active and the passive. While the deliberate confusion of these distinctions was a prerogative of the gods, the human blurring of gendered and bodily hierarchies could generate considerable social anxiety. Even in the marital bedroom, the distinction between masculine dominance and feminine passivity was often carefully guarded. According to some Mesopotamian sources, a husband was not to allow his wife to be on top during sex for fear it would rob him of his physical strength for a month. Centuries later, similar exhortations in the Babylonian Talmud would warn husbands that the same sexual position would curse them with diarrhea. It was a fear of female sexual dominance further reflected in early medieval Jewish debates about the malevolent winged demon Lilith. By then, some rabbis had recast this ancient Mesopotamian baby killer as Adam's first errant wife, who had insisted on assuming the dominant position in sex because, she said, she and Adam were of equal status. When her husband refused, she sensibly abandoned the marriage, flying away over Eden's garden wall. If heterosexual relationships were potentially hazardous, same-sex relationships were especially problematic. While the masculinist focus of ancient Southwest Asian literature tended not to notice sex between women, the phallic penetration of male bodies was a concern for some. The erotic dimensions of homosocial relationships were occasionally celebrated in myth and song. Both Gilgamesh in Mesopotamia and King David in Judah were said to treasure the love of a man more than that of any woman. But more often than not, the sexual consummation of these relationships bordered on the taboo. In some social groups, gender constructs both shifted and intersected with status and power, so that sex between men was slightly less offensive if the penetrated partner was of a lower social category than his lover. But penetrative sex between men of the same social status was unacceptable, for it improperly feminized the receptive partner by diminishing his masculinity. In a text among a collection known as the Middle Assyrian Laws, dated to about 1225 BCE, the punishment threatened for this crime is retributive and severe. The perpetrator is to be raped and then castrated, feminizing him sexually, socially, and physically. But the social impact of homoerotic sexual relationships was not restricted to the earthly realm, at least not as far as some biblical writers were concerned. In the eyes of Yahweh, who had a special concern for the phallic productivity of his worshippers, sex between men could be particularly troublesome. The fertility of semen was best not wasted, whether on menstruating wives, other men's women, or male sexual partners. Consequently, the intrusion of the life-giving, semen-shooting penis into the barren anal locus of dead feces was considered a highly toxic impurity, remedied only by the community expulsion or execution of both partners. From the most masculine to the non-masculine, the penis was the pivot around which ideologies of cultural power turned and the tool by which social order was calibrated. But it was not confined to war and sex alone. Phallocentric masculinity bound together many other aspects of ancient societies and the undergirding patriarchal systems by which they were held to flourish. Most crucially, all life within the cosmos was usually understood to be drawn from and depend upon the phallic potency of the divine male. Cultural insemination. In 1760, an eminent Swiss physician called Samuel Auguste David Tissot published the revised and expanded results of his research into the dangers of male masturbation, entitled L'onanisme, ou dissertation physique sur la maladie produite par la masturbation. A runaway success, it was quickly translated into German, Italian, and English, the expanded title of which rendered even more explicit the potential perils of a man's sexual self-satisfaction. Onanism, or a treatise upon the disorders produced by masturbation, or the dangerous effects of secret and excessive venery. As an advisor to the Vatican, Tissot's work fortuitously offered scientific, for its time, condemnation of what Western Christianity regarded as a heinous activity offensive to God. In the Bible, the deity had killed the unfortunate Onan for repeatedly spilling his seed, although in the story, the poor man's crime is not actually masturbation, but coitus interruptus. Tissot's manifesto against masturbation might have complemented church teaching, but it undermined a belief long held in the West that semen might harbour dangerous, even devilish powers. It was a view authoritatively endorsed by Augustine of Hippo, who centuries before had claimed that the sin of Adam and Eve was transmitted to every subsequent generation via corrupted semen. Instead, Tissot reasoned, semen was an unadulterated essential oil, more vital to the well-being of the male body than its blood. The loss of 1 ounce of semen, he asserted, was as hazardous as a blood loss of 40 ounces. Excessive ejaculation was thus deadly. Worse still, it might strip a man of his humanity, reducing him to a monstrous, non-human being, as Tissot's description of a compulsive masturbator suggests. I found a being that less resembled a living creature than a corpse lying upon straw, meagre, pale and filthy, casting forth an infectious stench. Almost incapable of motion, a watery palish blood issued from his nose. Slaver constantly flowed from his mouth. Having diarrhoea, he voided his excrement into the bed without knowing it. He was a spectacle, the horrible sight of which cannot be conceived, and it was difficult to discover that he had formerly made part of the human species. Although it was widely regarded at the time as a seminal work of scientific research, Tissot's study was in many ways a product of much older ideas about the male body. His emphasis on the vitality of semen echoes the highly influential Greek view shared by thinkers as divergent in their opinions as Hippocrates, circa 460 to 370 BCE, and Galen, circa 129 to 215 CE, that semen was the substance or transmitter of the vital force from which each human life derived and on which it survived, from the womb to the tomb. While Greek and later Western ideas about the reproductive capacities of a woman's seed or menstrual blood varied, semen was consistently understood as the agent of life. It sparked existence into being in utero, gifting the child its lifelong store of vitality, which had to be carefully managed lest it lingered too long, like rotting fruit, or spent out entirely, like a leaky trough. This masculinist conviction about the power of semen not only persisted well into the 19th century, but stretched back thousands of years, far beyond the golden age of Greek philosophical science, to the ancient cultures of Southwest Asia. From the early 3rd millennium BCE and well into the early centuries of the 1st millennium CE, there was at the very heart of these cultures a pervasive sense not only that semen was the source of new life, but that it was a substance so potent it was potentially dangerous. Whether divine, semi-divine or human, semen could impact the materiality of the cosmos and its inhabitants in both enlivening and destructive ways. In social terms, the high cultural value of semen in ancient Southwest Asia inevitably impacted the bodies and status of mortal women. Female bodies were held to shape, birth and nourish children, and their vulvas were considered organs of intense, intoxicating sexual allure. Yet generative power resided in the bodily fluids of men, especially their semen. Taken or received by the womb, semen acted as a clotting agent, curdling the blood residing passively inside the uterus into a fleshy child, an idea vividly illustrated in the Hebrew Bible when Job credits God with his conception. "Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews." The powerful agency of semen is perhaps a notion embedded in the very earliest cuneiform texts from about 3200 BCE, in which the ideogram or symbol for man appears to be an actively ejaculating penis, while woman is represented more passively by a pubic triangle. But it's also reflected in the distinctly gendered language of human sexual reproduction in subsequent ancient Southwest Asian literatures, including the Hebrew Bible, in which men are usually said to beget children while women simply bear them. Making babies was essentially a male activity, so much so the penis was closely identified with the other most creative part of the male body, the hand. Both body parts were especially valued as agents of skilled, productive, and transformative action. It's no surprise then to find that in many Southwest Asian texts, the word hand was a common synonym of the penis. The work of one corresponded to the work of the other. And so it is in the Hebrew Bible, in which it's a man's divinely ordained task to bring life into the world by the work of his yad, meaning hand or penis, whether it be impregnating a woman, keeping livestock, or tilling the land. Yahweh your God will make you abundantly prosperous in all the work of your hand / penis, in the fruit of your woman's womb, in the fruit of your cattle, and in the fruit of your soil. To a certain extent, the cultural privileging of the penis in these ancient societies is a stark reflection of the androcentric, elite perspectives of the scribes creating and compiling the texts on which we rely for information about the worlds in which they lived. This literature tended overwhelmingly to be produced by men, for men, and it was usually about men. But when complications in sex and reproduction arose, women were inevitably rendered more visible in the magical medical rituals preserved in some scribal compositions, which indicate that women were expected to play a key role in helping to remedy penis problems, particularly in treating childlessness. Infertility was not widely considered an affliction suffered by men. Childlessness, instead, signalled barren wives. Men might experience impotence, a condition often caused by the malevolent powers of sorcery, demons, or the restless ghosts of jealous young virgins, yet their fertility was rarely in doubt. The penis might well remain disappointingly flaccid, but the semen held within the body was not believed to be seedless. Magical cures harnessed the fecund forces pervading the cosmos to empower the penis of any man proverbially described in Mesopotamian texts as one whose youthful masculinity has left his loins like a runaway donkey. Some cures were probably quite effective in triggering an erection. In one Assyrian ritual, dated to about 1500 BCE, a woman is to take pulverized iron ore, the very stuff of hard weapons, mix it into oil, and instruct her husband to rub it onto his penis as she massages oil into her vulva. The ritual also recommends other restorative methods, such as talking dirty to him and encouraging him to envisage what, to all intents and purposes, looks to be bestial pornography. His wife tethers a stag to the head of the bed and a ram at its foot, rutting animals with whom her husband is magically identified. Then, somewhat intimidatingly for her partner, she shouts a powerful incantation. "The one at the head of my bed, get an erection, make love to me. The one at the foot of my bed, get an erection, make love to me. My vagina is the vagina of a bitch, his penis is the penis of a dog. As the vagina of a bitch holds fast the penis of a dog, so may my vagina hold fast his penis." As on earth, so in heaven. In myths across ancient Southwest Asia, fertility was almost exclusively a masculine trait exhibited by male deities. Sterility or barrenness in the world was not a manifestation of divine infertility, but nor was it a reflection of erectile dysfunction among the gods. Rather, it was a result of the deliberate withdrawal or absence of the masculine gods of fertility, who might retreat in response to insult or social disorder, or temporarily relocate to the wilderness or the underworld. The death and sterility their absences triggered starkly underscored their superior control of fecundity. It's a role evident in several traditions. When the Anatolian god Telepinu is suddenly angered, he puts his shoes on the wrong feet, storms out of the divine assembly and takes himself off into the wilderness. The impact is catastrophic. Barley and wheat no longer grow. Cows, sheep and humans no longer conceive. and those who are already pregnant do not give birth. Similarly, when the Ugaritic deity Baal is temporarily slain by the death god Mot, dried up are the furrows of the fields. It's only upon his resurrection from the underworld and return to the heavenly realm that the heavens rain down oil, the wadis run with honey. The calamitous impact of a disappearing deity is well known in the Bible too. When God vows to punish his people with a miscarrying womb and dry breasts, he threatens to do so by abandoning them. Israel's glory will fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. Even if they bring up children, I'll bereave them until no one is left. Woe to them indeed when I depart. These myths overturn the common and woefully reductive misconception that across the ancient pantheons of Southwest Asia, goddesses were primarily responsible for fertility. Instead, goddesses more usually looked after the womb, birth, and lactation in matters of human reproduction. But in the phallic cultures of this ancient world, they inevitably shared with their male peers a divine concern for the well-being and arousal of the human penis, and were frequently called upon to gift or empower the seductive sexual allure of humans of all genders. Although female deities might well bring into being other deities, semi-divine heroes, and humans, they often required both the assent and the semen, blood, tears, spit, sweat, or wet breath of divine masculinity to do so. By contrast, male deities could entirely forego female cooperation and create new life alone. In an ancient Egyptian myth, the high god Atum does precisely this when he masturbates the universe into existence. Ejaculating into his mouth, he spits and sneezes out his semen to create the male deity of airy space, Shu, and the female deity of sweet moisture, Tefnut. I am the one who acted as husband with my fist. I copulated with my hand. I let fall into my own mouth. I sneezed Shu and spat Tefnut. As Atum's hand acts as a wife's vagina, so his mouth and nostrils function as birth canals. His divine twins have sex and bring into being subsequent generations of sexually active deities, all of whom partner with a deity of the opposite sex to contribute to the further creation of the cosmos. Although the building of the universe relies on what we would recognise as heterosexual reproduction, the cosmos is initially stimulated into existence by Atum's powerful act of masturbation and also fellatio. Other male deities across the region might also ingest semen and carry pregnancies, but divine semen was so intensely fecund it could pose a danger even to male gods themselves. In a Sumerian myth, the well-endowed deity Enki discovered this to his cost. Immensely proud of the generative power of his enormous penis, he takes to lurking in his marshlands, his erections sticking out, waiting for a young goddess to pass by so that he can impregnate her in what looks to modern eyes to be sexual coercion, if not rape. Having conceived and then coerced several generations of his own daughters in this way, his first victim, Ninhasaga, takes matters into her own hands. She wipes his semen from the genitals of his youngest daughter Utu and sows it into the earth, cursing Enki to consume the plants that sprout from his seed. He becomes pregnant and dangerously unwell, as severe pain grips his head, hair, nose, mouth, throat, arms, ribs, and sides. Nonetheless, eight deities are successfully created from his own ingested semen. The physical ramifications of ingested semen and pregnancy for a male deity are also explored in Anatolian traditions of the late 2nd millennium BCE, detailing the escapades of the rebellious Kumarbi, last seen pulling down the high god Anu from the heights of heaven and biting off his genitals. Having swallowed the god's penis and testicles, Kumarbi realises three offspring are inside him. Like Egyptian Atum, he spits out two new deities, but the third remains within his body, rapidly growing into a formidable rival. Kumarbi understandably worries about how to birth him. It's an anxiety shared by his unborn son, the terrifying warrior god Tahun, who is repulsed at the thought of emerging into the world via his father's rectum. It's only by smashing open his head against the cliffs of Mount Tarsa that Kumabi reluctantly enables the new god to break out of his body, a skull birth Zeus similarly experiences in delivering his warring daughter Athena. In all these myths, divine semen is so potent it can bring forth life even without a female body to gestate and birth it. And yet the stories about Enki and Kumabi also warn against the potential dangers of divine self-procreation. When motivated by hubris, it might result in catastrophic disorder. The parent's body might be damaged or diminished, or he might give birth to dangerous or rebellious progeny. For this reason, perhaps, the phallocentrism of self-procreation is often subverted by a telling emphasis on the machinations and interventions of goddesses. When Enki ingests his own semen plants, it's because he's been tricked and cursed by Ninhasaga. The trauma his pregnancy inflicts on his body is only remedied when he's inserted into the vulva of the reconciliatory goddess, enabling him to birth his children from the safety of her vagina. Fortuitously, each one is a healing deity who cures Enki's afflicted body parts. When Kumabi births his son from his smashed-in head, he must rely on the midwifery of the fate goddesses, who tend the wound and sew up his skull, perhaps alluding to the seams between the plates in the human cranium, and restore his body to wholeness. The thrust of these myths is a cautionary warning that while male deities can indeed self-procreate, to bring new life into the world without female cooperation is risky. An ordered cosmos is a universe in which the ultra-potent semen of male deities is often best processed or managed by female bodies. It's a cultural caution the God of the Bible frequently ignores. Although he's best known in the West for using the body of a mortal woman to carry and birth his divine son, he's also presented as a god whose patriarchal masculinity is so extreme and so intolerant of other deities and their generative powers that he not only takes on the midwifery roles traditionally ascribed to goddesses, but repeatedly exhibits his own ability to bring new life into being by means of his own body. Given the sensitivities of the biblical writers, many of these stories have been stripped of their mythic features, screening the fertile body of God from direct view. But the texts nonetheless display his powers as the supreme divine progenitor. Best known, of course, is God's creation of the first human. In older but comparable Mesopotamian traditions, a mixed-gendered team of gods combines clay with the blood or semen of a deity to make humankind. But in Genesis, God emphatically acts alone. Yahweh God formed a human, Adam, from the dust of the ground, Adama, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the human became a living being. Less well known, however, is God's use of his breath to create Lady Wisdom, the name biblical scholars give to the goddess figure known as Chokhmah in Hebrew texts and Sophia in Greek language Jewish texts. Popular from at least the 4th century BCE onwards, Lady Wisdom was said to have accompanied God at the creation of the world. In the 2nd century BCE book of Sirach, also known in Jewish tradition as Ben Sira and to Christians as Ecclesiasticus, she boasts of her privileged status and describes her birth from God's body. In the assembly of the Most High, she opens her mouth. In the presence of his hosts, she tells of her glory. I came forth from the mouth of the Most High and covered the earth as a mist. I dwelt in the highest heavens, and my throne was in a pillar of cloud. Like the Egyptian god Atum, God not only creates a divine being identified with the moist air, but does so by expelling her from his mouth. And Lady Wisdom is not the only one to emerge from his body. In a much older poem incorporated into Deuteronomy, itself predating Sirach by several centuries, God births a son called Jeshurun, a legendary figure subsequently identified with the great ancestor Jacob. The poem appears to reflect an ancient myth repurposed to describe the Israelites' turbulent relationship with their deity. Although only fragments of the myth appear in this complex composition, its gist is reasonably clear. God is presented in primeval form as the fertile rock, a divine title alluding to the creative divine presence of both the cosmic mountain at the centre of the world and an unhewn standing stone in a cult place. He's called the father and progenitor of Jeshurun, whom he tends in the wilderness. In the barrenness of Jeshurun's desert home, God nurtures his son with the rich food of the gods, but Jeshurun exploits the nourishing love of his parent, growing fat, bloated, and gorged. Eventually, he rebels against his father, abandoning him to honour instead other deities who had not birthed him. Rarely one to cope well with rejection, God is furious. In language explicitly highlighting his bodily conception and delivery of the child, he cries out, "You are unmindful of rock who bore you. You forgot God who gave birth to you." Within many modern Jewish and Christian communities, it's become spiritually comforting, if not socially strategic, to read into this biblical myth of the birthing, nurturing rock, a more inclusive, liberalised theology by which the masculine God of the Bible is either rendered more palatably female, feminine, or maternal, or his powers of fertility are subsumed into bodiless, sexless, genderless abstraction. But this is to miss the point. The ability to self-procreate was a characteristic of the most powerful male gods, a graphic assertion of a potent hypermasculinity, reflecting the widespread understanding that the divine male body and the semen, spit, blood, and moist breath it might produce was the fertile source of all life in the cosmos. Like most deities, self-procreating gods were not constrained by the physiological limitations imposed on their human worshippers, nor were they restricted to the more conventional gender roles associated with mortal bodies. As such, the self-procreative birthing of new life did not undermine the maleness of the God of the Bible. Instead, it amplified the fecund, unrivaled masculinity of God's body, a body onto which was mapped the status and value of mortal men's bodies and their own phallic, seminal power.